That, of course, was the iconic Whitney Houston singing one of the most iconic versions of our national anthem. So Francis Scott Key is enshrined in America's iconography as a paragon of patriotism on par with Betsy Ross, Patrick Henry, Paul Revere, and John Hancock, individuals who hold exalted places in American history for performing one memorable act. For Key, it was writing the Star-Spangled Banner under the most dramatic and unlikely of circumstances. One of the most famous, admired, and accomplished men in the early American Republic, Key was a patriotic, pious, hardworking, and well-connected Washington, D.C. lawyer. He had a thriving private legal practice, argued more than 100 cases before the newly formed Supreme Court, and served as a U.S. attorney in Washington for 8 years. Confidant of President Andrew Jackson, Key was a member of Old Hickory's kitchen cabinet and handled many sensitive legal matters for the Jackson administration. Historian Mark Leibson put a book out some years ago called What So Proudly We Hailed. And since it's a long July 4th weekend, we invited Mark to tell us that story. Mark, let's first talk about a little background. Who is Francis Scott Key?
Well, he was a prominent lawyer in Washington, D.C. He was 35 years old when he went up to Baltimore to help arrange a prisoner release after the War of 1812 Battle of Bladensburg. That's when the British burned Washington, D.C. And he was chosen because he was a friend of the family of the man who was taken prisoner, a surgeon named William Beans. And so he went up to Baltimore and helped arrange the prisoner release. And while after the British said, okay, but we're not going to let you go until we bomb Baltimore back to the Stone Age. So Key and Beans and another man were held, not held, but just under guard in a ship, and they watched the Battle of Baltimore.
And this was the origins. The song came out of the 2.5-year War of 1812, and it was at Fort McHenry during this Battle of Baltimore. And he wrote a poem about his experience in Baltimore, and the poem was called The Defense of Fort McHenry, right?
That's correct, yeah. You know, Key was an amateur poet, not a very good amateur poet, I'm afraid, but he was inspired that night to write words that what tens of millions of Americans have known by heart for, you know, decades and decades. This was a 25-hour bombardment. The British were really trying to destroy Baltimore. 25 hours nonstop, overnight, 1,500 mortars, shells, cannonballs. It might have been the longest sustained bombardment in history up to that point. And there was a giant thunderstorm that night, which people might not know. So it was quite an amazing thing. And Key was moved to in the morning when he realized that the Americans had prevailed, our flag was still there, when he saw the Star-Spangled Banner, to write these words on the back of a letter that he had in his pocket.
Well, I was going to say, the experience alone, I mean, he felt this whole thing from his soul, obviously.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, he was a versifier. You know, he loved to write poems. They were only meant for family and friends, really. They were not meant to be. But actually, a group of his poems was published after he died. He didn't really want it. And it's available on Google Books. I mean, anybody can read it, and they can see for themselves that he wasn't a very inspired poet, but except for this one night, as I said earlier.
Well, how did it make it to the public eye? How did people get to see this? Where did he publish it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We really don't know exactly how, but a couple of days later, these words appeared on a broadsheet, which was distributed all over Baltimore, kind of like a poster. And then a couple of months later, a music shop in Baltimore printed the words on sheet music, and it was said to be sung to a tune that was very well known at the time called To Anacreon in Heaven. And the poem, originally titled Defense of Fort McHenry, was retitled The Star-Spangled Banner, and it became a popular patriotic air at that time in the early Republic, but just one of several. And then it kind of picked up momentum about 100 years later in the early 20th century, and then it became the official national anthem in 1931.
Yeah, amazing. And what did we have until that point? I mean, was it America the Beautiful, America at that point?
Yeah, we had several. Yankee Doodle was one of them, America the Beautiful. None was official, though, until Congress passed a resolution and President Hoover signed it into law in March of 1931.
Now, Francis Scott Key, now being that he wrote the national anthem and wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, he was tone deaf, wasn't he?
Well, we don't know that he was tone deaf, but the family did say he was unmusical. You know, he was not, definitely not a songwriter. He did not write songs, but he wrote these poems, and he also, interestingly enough, did not make a big deal out of what he wrote that night. You know, He spoke of it publicly once in his entire life. He lived until 1843. This was 1814. He only spoke of it publicly once in a political speech he made. And in all the letters he wrote, I could only find one in which he even talked about what happened that night, nor have other historians found anything he actually wrote about that song. So there are some certain mysteries about how the song came to be and how it came to be the national anthem.
More of Mark Leibson and the history of the Star-Spangled Banner on this long Independence Day weekend right after this on 720 WGN.
Dave Pryor, WGN.
Mark, as a lawyer, Francis Scott Key, one of the most notable aspects of his character was the advocacy for African Americans whose slavery cases he accepted free of charge.
That's correct. He was a slave owner from a slave-owning family, but he was also adamantly against slave trafficking, and he represented free blacks and slaves in the courts in Washington, D.C. So slavery was a big part of his life. He was also a founding member of the American Colonization Society in 1816, and one of its strongest supporters. He was on the board of managers for many, many years, and that was the group that sent free blacks, not slaves, but free blacks to a colony in Africa that would become the colony and then the nation of Liberia.
But how does that, you know, as a slave owner himself, how does that make any sense?
Well, you know, you can't get away from the issue of slavery when you're dealing with prominent people who had an impact on the national life in the early republic. Everything right up leading to the Civil War, slavery is something you can't get away from. And so, you know, here's Francis Scott Key, who was against slave trafficking. He was, represented. He had a reputation throughout the city of Washington, if not the republic, for being a friend of blacks, and yet he was one of the most important voices in this colonization movement, which was very controversial, and because abolitionists just hated it. Mm-hmm. So it's just a fact of life when you're dealing with someone of that prominence.
At that time.
Yeah.
What is the story behind Key's controversial actions? He was a U.S. attorney during the first race riot in Washington in 1835.
Right, yeah. He was U.S. attorney, and he had arrested a man for possessing abolitionist literature. At the same time, there was a slave in Washington who was accused of threatening to kill his mistress and, you know, the woman who owned him. And those two events got crowds riled up. There were lynch mobs. Key actually helped stem the riot at first by calming the crowds and saying, you know, these men were going to be taken to justice. And then word got out that a tavern owner, a restaurant owner named Snow, it's called the Snow Riot, who was an African-American, he had a restaurant in downtown Washington, had said something bad about white women. Anyway, there was 2 days of rioting, and Key was right in the middle of it, because of the prosecution of this abolitionist and because of the prosecution of Arthur Bowen, the slave. So it was, no one was killed, but a lot of property was damaged, and it was a very fearsome thing that happened in the nation's capital.
Now, as U.S. attorney, too, he was a confidant of President Andrew Jackson as well during that time, wasn't he?
Correct, yeah. He disdained politics for most of his life. He said it was just too bitter and too contentious, but then he got enamored of Andrew Jackson and campaigned for him in 1828, and then he became a member of Jackson, a close advisor of Jackson and a member of his kitchen cabinet, which was, you know, his informal advisors, mostly his friends from Tennessee, but also Francis Scott Key, who met, you know, aside from his formal cabinet.
Now, as you mentioned, the song was adopted as the American national anthem first by executive order from President Woodrow Wilson in 1916, and then by a congressional resolution in 1931 signed by President Herbert Hoover. And the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah. Yeah. After the song became known right after he wrote it in 1814 and 1810s, it was a popular song, but not the national. There was no official national anthem. It was one of many, I'd say a half a dozen patriotic airs that were played at patriotic events. And things, it was sort of the de facto national anthem for the North during the Civil War, but things really picked up steam as we got toward the 20th century, and the military, the Navy, and the Army adopted it as the official national anthem. Wilson wanted it. It started to be played at baseball games in the,
right.
in the early teens. But it really wasn't until 1931, as you mentioned, that Congress passed a resolution and President Hoover signed it into law. So it's only been the official national anthem since 1931.
Well, I mean, really, and for the general public, I mean, when we really do hear it, I mean, we might see it from a military show or something, but for the most part, it's sporting events that we sing it, and we know it from there.
Yeah, that's correct. And that didn't start until the World Series. I think it was 1912 or 1913. And then it was just played at World Series. Then it was opening day. And then it just, you know, got for every, you know, now at high school events we see it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, folks, that was just a few of the highlights. And you can read much more of the history of our national anthem and the story of Francis Scott Key with the book What So Proudly We Hailed. It's available at Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. And for more on historian Mark Leepsen, you can visit his website at Mark, and that's Mark with a C, Leepsen, L-E-E-P-S-O-N.com.